Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Laura Bennett. This season, we're focusing once again on the New York Comedy Club and cultural institution Comedy Cellar, which was founded in 1982 and has been the starting ground for comedians like Chris Rock and Jon Stewart and Sarah Silverman and many, many others. This week, we are talking to Esti Adoram, who has been the Comedy Cellar's booker for nearly four decades. Esti is something of a legend in the comedy world. Just to give you a sense of the way comedians revere and fear her judgment, here is a representative quote from Sarah Silverman in Vanity Fair's Oral History of the Cellar. She said, "I remember the terror of bombing in front of Esti. She just likes who she likes, and that's that. To this day, if she comes downstairs and checks out my set, I get nervous." I've heard similar reports from many of the people I've talked to, so I was very excited to meet Esti. And she was just as fascinating and frank and fun to talk to as I'd imagined. Once again, we're at the Olive Tree Cafe next door to the Cellar, which is basically the club's backstage, in that it's where all the comedians hang out before and after shows. What's your name and what do you do?
Hi, I'm Esti. I'm Esti Adoram. I'm the booker for the Comedy Cellar.
I would add the legendary booker for the Comedy Cellar, a sort of a fixture in the wider cultural world who so many people have mentioned to me as I've been starting to sort of research the Comedy Cellar and talk to some other people. How does it make you uncomfortable when I say that?
No, well deserved. No. No, it just... I outlast everybody. That's why I became a legend. Not for any other reason.
So tell me how you got your start here. When was it and how did it happen?
I started here in 82 as a hostess downstairs at the Cellar. And then gradually, as people were either dying or leaving their jobs, I got part of their job. And when Bill Grunfuss moved to LA to write for Mad About You,
so he was the booker before you became the booker?
He's the one that started the Comedy Cellar with Manny,
yep.
Manny Dwarman. So when he left, I took over and been at it ever since. And then we added shows and added rooms and added Vegas. You know, it just blossomed.
And I believe I've read that you served in the Israeli army before you came here.
Yes,
is that
I did.
True?
Yes.
Are there any shared skills required both by being in the Israeli army and being a booker at the Comedy Cellar?
You've got to have a certain personality to last. As a booker, in the army, you don't have a choice.
So what's that personality? So
you cannot be a wimp on either one.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that makes sense. That's a good answer. So do you feel like your sort of style and sensibility in making lineups and being a booker was different from the style and sensibility of the guy who was booking lineups before you?
It evolved. It is different, but not for any particular reason. We just evolved. We grew. New people came. There were new opportunities. And so for that reason, I would say yes. But not because I'm so wonderful.
How has your sensibility evolved in doing your job since you started?
You develop a sense what's going to work and what doesn't. And sometimes it's even for me difficult to say, well, this will work, this doesn't. You cannot throw things around. There is a reason why somebody's on the lineup. Somebody follows somebody. Somebody I wouldn't challenge for following somebody. You know, the do's and don'ts. But that really develops, it's a sense of familiarity. I'm familiar with situations now, you know. And so it's easier for me to predict that so-and-so will work or not. It still doesn't mean that I am 100% right.
What makes a good lineup? What have you figured out in your years of doing this?
Funny people.
you've got a book.
Yeah. Look, throughout the years, there's different things that people try to do, whether they're politically correct, especially the environment right now. I've got to ignore that. I mean, I've got to be sensitive to it, but I've got to ignore it.
To ignore what exactly?
The pressure, the outside pressure to do things a certain way. I've always prided myself that I book the shows on merit, availability, looking for the right, you know, have my ear to the ground, sort of. And based on that, I'll book the show. I am not going to book because I am told that now is the year of the woman. Well, year for the woman, for me, it's been a long time, a year for a woman. So it's all, you know, relative.
Well, it sounds like maybe you're referring obliquely to the Louis C.K. stuff.
No, I'm not, but I knew you're going to go there.
Well, I was going to save it, but now that you mentioned it.
What happened with Louis is unfortunate, and it's just sometimes enough is enough. There is a backlash, and Noam Dworman, the owner, dealt with stuff like you cannot even imagine. And we're trying to be very sensitive to the club, to the other comics, because some of those comics suddenly became holier than thou.
Right.
You know?
And what do you mean by that? Like that?
It just, well, you know, he should never work.
Right.
He
right,
should
right,
never.
Right.
Really? That's not right either. There is a happy medium, and in the same wave of Louis C.K., they were trying to throw other people that did really nothing, like Aziz. You know, it became this thing and not an individual case. And so booking the show, I have to sort of ignore it.
Did it give you pause about who to let on the stage going forward, if not from any kind of ideological standpoint, then from a strictly practical standpoint to avoid backlash like that, or you just tune it all out?
I need to tune it out. I never book the shows based on politics, favorite. If I have a show and I don't have a good female comic available, I'm not going to just throw a comic so I have a woman on the show. If I have six fantastic males or color, race, religion, I can't fall yet. I try to be sensitive to it. I try. And luckily, lately, we have more availabilities. But once in a while, I have a show that I don't have a woman. And it's only because that day I didn't have a good woman available.
And when that happens, do you get emails saying, why didn't you
yes.
have a woman on the
yes.
Do you respond to those?
No. I mean, what I'm going to say, people actually do know. If they really are fans of comedy, if you're a fan of comedy, you sort of know that those things happen.
You know, this is a question I asked Noam too, but I'm curious for your thoughts as well. Obviously, you've been at this for a long time, and the cultural world has changed a lot over the past few decades with social media and the rise of what people call cancel culture, which is kind of what you're talking about, where a comedian does something deemed offensive and then becomes kind of radioactive. Has that ratcheting up debate about political correctness affected how you do your job at all?
No, unless it's somebody, and it's not from political correctness, but if somebody really, quote unquote, misbehaves on stage.
And what does that mean?
They're running the light. They're taking out the frustration on the paying audience. They just not professional.
Can you think of an example of
I'm not going to say it. You know I can't say it, but there are
right,
people.
Right, they don't have to name any names, but what does it look like to take out your frustration on the audience?
They can yell at them, they can reprimand them, to the point that everybody is just sitting like, you know, stone-faced. What's important, and we all sort of don't think about it as much as we should, myself included. People come out, they take maybe a babysitter, they travel, they pay, not to sit and be abused. And so to me, this is a bigger issue than somebody that had a bad date. If I book a show, I would stay away from somebody that I don't trust to put on the stage that they'll do their best.
Right. So you're talking a little bit about how you put together a lineup. So the order of comedians, I'm sure, is an art that seems totally opaque to anybody who hasn't done this before. What is the formula? I mean, is you start strong and then sort of you break up the rhythm of the night?
No, it's customized. It's going to start, let's see who is emceeing the show. If my MC is very high energy, I can afford to open the show with less energy.
That's
although I prefer to have high energy everybody. But they are not. Some comics are very, very good, but they low energy, you know? Historically speaking, Stephen Wright used to work here. There was nobody lower energy, and he was hilarious and went through. So I take that under consideration. So if I have six people on the show and I have six availability for knockout strong people, I'll do that. But I'll see who is the MC, who is the first. Close always strong. But it's also really important to open strong to get their attention right away. You know?
What makes a really good MC?
High energy, warmth. The MC has to have warmth, a welcoming quality. I mean, the jokes, it's important to have good jokes. But if there is an issue, some kind of an issue during the night, the host is supposed to be the one that smoothens it out, that makes it all better. And so for me, this is the number one quality. And number two is be aware of the show. Don't run it late, because if you run late, somebody's going to get, their time is going to get cut. They're not going to get to do what they're supposed to do. So it's a sort of a manager of the show. And so that's what I look for.
What happens if it's a weekend night and suddenly Dave Chappelle and Amy Schumer and Jerry Seinfeld and Chris Rock show up and they all want to go on?
They
what
do.
What do you do?
They do.
Do you have to boot other people?
Well, it's sort of the name of the game. The guys that work here, they know that someday when they're nice and big, they'll be able to have the luxury to do that as well. As a club, it would be foolish, stupid not to put those people on. First of all, most of them started here. So I have books from years and years ago where Chris Rock used to do late night. You know what I mean?
What's late night? Like what time would he do?
After midnight, very short spots, you know. All those people came through, except Seinfeld, he did not. But, you know, all the others did come through here. So we are sort of a little bit of a home for them. And, yeah.
When those guys come through now, what do you think? I mean, are they testing out new material for specials? Are they just coming home? Why do you think they come back?
Combination. Some of them work on something new, maybe a special, maybe a show, maybe a gig. And some of them just want to be part of the comedian community again. They enjoy it. Chris Rock will come sometimes and not go on, just sit and you know, talk to the other comics.
Do you try to get him to go on when that happens?
I just ask him if he wants to. If he wants to, great. If he doesn't, I don't push it. He knows he can go on. And sometimes if one of them goes on, suddenly the second one wants to go on. You know what I mean?
Right.
There is this little thing between them.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Why do you think so many comedians say that you make them nervous?
I don't know. I'm such a nice person, right? Liz?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, even big comics told me that I do
I've
make
read
them
it all over the place.
Yeah, some of them maybe I do. I know it's a question that they don't want to disappoint because they have this big reputation, and if they do new stuff, maybe that stuff is not going to work. And I really don't know. I can't be in their head. I always try to be very supportive and very, you know, open. And if they come to my house and I host them, that's how I host them here.
How long do you think it took you to get good at your job? Did you feel like
day one. Well, I tell you what.
What makes you good at your job?
I think it didn't take me that long because I used to host downstairs before I started booking. So I had the sense and the eye out, you know what I mean? When Bill used to book and I used to see what works, what doesn't. And then we had comics that they were our favorite and they always went over. So that was the easy thing to do. I start with them. Now, all those years later where I have to introduce new people, young comics, I have to see if there is a seed and they can develop.
So how do you identify that seed?
I can tell you. It's a quality, it's somebody that's not a hack. And I actually don't like the word hack because I think it's
right,
used too loosely. Yeah, it's not. But you can sense it.
Can you remember the last time, most recently, you had that feeling about somebody who came into audition?
Oh, boy. I can't remember. I've been auditioning so many people now.
Really?
So, more than usual.
Why is that?
Because we have more shows and the Comedy Central show this week at the Comedy Cellar. And so I have tons and tons of people. I mean, there's some people that I watch. Matteo Lane. The first time I saw him, I fell in love with him, you know? And Daniel Summerson. When you see them, you know it.
So
you
what about
know
it made you fall in love with that guy?
They're funny. They're funny. Just plain and simple, funny. And, you know, there are some people that are funny, but they're also aggressive and angry. They're not.
Right.
It's easy to like them. Some people I like, I develop love for them. But it's hard work sometimes. Like my favorite years past was Greg Giraldo. But I was worried.
Why were you worried?
Because he had an edge to him and there had issues going on and whatever. But his stuff was so good. And he was great. He was just the greatest guy ever. But I was always, you know, I always felt my shoulders rising when I was listening to him. And we were super close and whatever. But these guys, when I watch them, it's just like, ah, party. It's great. And then I look at the audience and they feel the same thing.
Yeah.
I see the same reaction.
So how do auditions work?
Usually it's by recommendation of a comedian that works here on the regular lineup. And then I'll check, and now it's so much easier. I used to ask for a tape and whatever. Now you just watch links on YouTube. I get an idea, and then if I think that that's going to work, I invite them to do 5 minutes on either Friday or Saturday night.
Why Friday or Saturday?
Because those are the nights I work at night. And there is an audience, and there is always a positive vibe going on. It's better. And then I listen to them. I listen to the set. I see the reaction. I pay attention to the reaction. And if I love them, great. If I am not sure, I'll maybe give them a set or two and see what happens. And that usually tells the story.
Do you ever find yourself looking through YouTube to try to kind of recruit or find
No. Mm-hmm. Do you know how many people are doing comedy right
so
now?
So many.
And those people really, a lot of them shouldn't. But yeah, it's recommendation of comics and recommendation of managers or agents there's some of them I trust throughout the years, you know? And they say, oh, they just signed up somebody, he's wonderful. Some agents come to me, says, can I have a phone number of so-and-so? I want to, the other way around,
and
you know?
And you'll say yes?
Absolutely.
Right, and you got to
absolutely, why not? If I can help them, of course.
One thing I've read is that a thing you look for in assessing comedians is how they react to bombing. You don't even remember.
I have no idea what you mean.
What I mean everyone tells jokes that don't land well sometimes, but a good comedian knows how to basically skate past that and move on to the next thing, and that's a measure of the kind of grace and ability, agility,
well,
if you will.
Once a comedian is a professional comedian, they pretty much know to ignore it. Remember what I mentioned with the comics that I am worried about or stand away from? Is the comics that if the joke doesn't land,
right,
that they take it on the audience.
Right, right. No, that's
so that's what I meant. That's what I mentioned before. Maybe
right.
That's why I mentioned in the thing you read. What sometimes amazes me, that somebody comes and auditions and they don't do well and they still expect me to, okay, so when, you know?
What do you say in those cases?
Well, I try to be nice and considerate because I see how nervous they are when they come. I mean, grown men, you know, getting flushed and whatever. They perspire and, you know. So I know that for them, it's a huge deal to be passed here. That's another expression I really don't like is passed, to work here.
Right.
But what sometimes really I don't understand is that It's quiet. It's crickets. They're not doing well, and they're not aware of it. Why would you come and ask me, how did I do it? You were with me in the room. That always embarrasses me a little bit. I try not to be hard on people because, as I said, I know what it means to them, how much they put into that. Some people, if I see that maybe there is something, I'll say, you know what, let's have another audition 6 months from now or something like that. And I'll take a look again. But it's getting a little bit harder. Look, if you take a pick up any lineup and you see who is working here, I'm not going to use that person, but use somebody that got no response and no, you know what I mean? It makes no sense. And I cannot expect a new comic to understand or think about it, but I have to think about it.
Can you remember the best audition you ever saw?
Chappelle.
Oh, so tell me about it. You had a really fast answer for that.
Because I met him, I think he was 18 years old. He was sitting in the last booth over there. He was eating. He wasn't working here. And I was end of the night sitting in the end of the bar, and somebody came over and said, you see this guy over there? I saw him in D.C., and he's pretty amazing. And that person never recommended anyone. So that perked my curiosity. I went over, I introduced myself, and I asked him if he's willing to go on and do a few minutes for me. Sure, you know. And he went on, and he did a Popeye bit. I mean, I can't tell you. And that was like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Popeye bit at 3 o'clock in the morning,
yes.
And it kills.
I was laughing so hard. I came upstairs, I called Manny, Noam's father, and I told him at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, you are not going to believe, I just saw something really special. And that was the first time I met Chappelle.
So what did you say to Chappelle? You were like, how soon can you come back?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime, call me. Here's my number. He's my da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, the whole spiel. And he did.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Have you ever done comedy yourself?
No.
Would you ever do comedy yourself?
No.
I feel like you'd be pretty good.
No.
Just watching so many comedians night after night make you more or less inclined to do comedy.
I never even contemplated it. I would not. No, that's not for me.
Were you a fan of comedy growing up before you started in here?
No. Not but at what I find fascinating with comedians is, you know, as far as an art form, stand-up comedy is different than any other art form. They are performing their own writing, their own words, their own personality. They expose themselves, you know, they stand there naked in front of the audience, so to speak. And the judgment is swift. Either they accept you and they like you or they don't. Either you hear laughter or you don't. That takes a very special individual. Not everybody can take it. And those that do, and did do well with that, those are the ones that are the breakthrough comics.
Can you think of your favorite lineup you've ever put together?
God, jeez. No, I mean, the lineup on a regular basis, if you take a look, you know, with availability in town, it's incredible. I mean, I have some the biggest names and the best comics. And I mix it with the standards, with the new ones. With, you know, let's say on Friday I have 10 shows. So I have the opportunity to do that, to mix it like that.
What is your dream lineup if you could get anyone in the world, even people who haven't performed here ever, who would be in it?
No, I'm good.
You're good?
I'm good, really. I mean, a comic that is all the way up there, the whatever, it doesn't mean that he's going to have a great set. You'll be surprised how unforgiving the audience is. I was so excited to see so-and-so, but he came with a paper and a note, and he was terrible.
You mean a paper like he's reading his jokes from
a
paper?
Yeah,
I feel like I once saw someone here read jokes from a phone, and I was damn.
Yeah, exactly. But they don't care that this is X, Y, and Z, big name, famous person. They just want to laugh. And sometimes the younger comic, the more energetic and prepared, will do better. So for me to say my dream lineup...
So there's no one who's like your white whale, so to speak, who you've tried to get to come here and hasn't, you haven't been able to yet?
I'm sure that there is, and I can't think of that. I'm sure there is somebody.
It's hard to think of a really big.
Yeah, because most of them do work here. Yeah, most of them do work here, and I have the luxury of, you know, booking the best people.
So what does a typical day here look like for you?
Well, it depends on the day. Usually Monday and Tuesday I work from home, and that's where I do the lineups. I take availabilities Saturday through Sunday, and Monday I just start the lineups and finalize it on Tuesday.
So do you sit down?
Yeah.
And how do what's your process if you had to really break it down of putting together a lineup? Do you have a bunch of names of people who you know are available and then you kind of put the puzzle together?
Well, they email me with their conflicts, with their, you know, I have so-and-so, whatever. And so I take it and on paper I just break it down show by show, not day by day, but show by show. And then I look and, well, these people maybe are better for earlier. These people can do earlier or late. Some of them cannot do late.
So what do you mean? What, when someone can't do
energy,
late, why can't they?
The energy, they get tired. I mean, they're people, you know? I can see sometimes when the 12:15 show starts, it actually starts at 12:30 or later. And I can see on the faces, the eyes are getting red and, you know. And some people are more vulnerable to that. And some people are much better early. So I put everybody in their little cubbyhole that I think it works. And then I choose this one against this one. Who is better?
Does anyone ever say to you, oh man, I don't want to be going so late. Can you put me in an earlier slot? And you have to like navigate the preferences and egos?
Sometimes.
West Village traffic.
Sometimes they do. But not because they don't like working late, but because, let's say, they have to catch an early flight the next day or they have to get up with their kids. Then they would ask. Some people don't have to ask me. I mean, I've been doing it for so long. I know them. I know them really, really well. And I can get the best from somebody that is up and bushy. You know what I mean?
Who are the most fun comedians to work with for you?
I love when Colin Quinn is around. By the way, he's taping his special tonight. And Robert and Keith Robinson, you know. But these people are grandfathered in.
Right.
I mean, we've been together for so long. Tom Papa, you know. These people, at least once or twice a year, we go out to dinner to Del Frisco or something. There is a relationship that develop, but I am here 37 years. These guys are here also a very long time. So we're talking about spending holidays while working together in the early days, you know, and just growing up together. We sort of grew up together.
Do you ever get tired of listening to comedians, or do you still find the job as exciting as you did when
I do. I like it. I mean, some people, material is more interesting to me than others. There are some people that always have new stuff. Some people repeat themselves. So the one that always have new stuff, I'm always eager to hear, well, you know, Attell, you never know. Attell will come up with, say, well, how did you think about it even, you know? So yeah, that's what it is.
Do you ask him that? Or are you like, how did you even come up with that stuff?
Oh, it's useless to ask him. You're not going to get
just
an answer.
Know.
Nah.
When you go to other comedy clubs, do you go to other comedy clubs?
Very rarely, but yes.
But when you go, what kinds of observations or judgments do you find yourself having about their lineups?
Sometimes I wonder, there are so many good people in town. Why do you use X, Y, and Z?
It's reasonable.
Why the air conditioning is not working? The room is hot, everybody is falling asleep. Why the lights look like a cafeteria and not a club? Why the sound is so bad, you know? Those are all those ingredients. When you used to go to Letterman, everybody used to say, oh my God, it was freezing. There's a reason for that.
Keep people awake and alert?
Absolutely. Those are those little things that people take for granted. Many, and now know them, are very gifted when it comes to decor, sound, light, atmosphere. This is so important. people say, oh, the Comte de Sales is so intimate. But the Village Underground, it's twice as big, and you still feel intimate.
Right.
So why can, you know, I don't want to give other people ideas, but if I do go, that's what I look at.
Who books when you go on vacation or something?
Oh, no, I book all the time.
You don't go on vacation?
Even when, if I do, I still book.
You still book?
Oh, yeah.
Never take a break?
No.
Why is that? You just feel, like, invested in the place?
Of course. No, I mean, look, nowadays, there is a computer, and there is a website, and there is phones. And I have it also organized that it's not so terrible. And I like doing it.
Why do you like it so much? What makes you so happy about doing this job?
Why do I like it? I don't know. It's something fun to do. I feel satisfaction.
It's satisfying to be really good at something.
Yes. And when I'm done and I look at the lineup, so this is good.
What are your feelings on canceled spots?
It depends why. I mean, if somebody's sick, you're sick. If somebody gets a money gig, I would never begrudge a comedian to get a $10,000, $15,000 job. So, you know, so those are legitimate cancellations. When the cancellation becomes very frequent and very, it's very arbitrary. They just do, you know, whatever, didn't feel good. There's times I have no cancellations at all. Today, I had like 5 of them.
Really?
Yeah. And I was like, oh, one more, and I'm...
Well, that's why you made that face when I asked how your day was so far.
Yeah.
A lot of
back and forth.
Right.
But I'm lucky. Most people don't cancel, and don't cancel easily. And as I said, I mean, whether I like it or not, how can I begrudge? To do the job well, you have to love those guys. You've got to appreciate them. You've got to respect them. And I told you before why. They are really special individuals. And if you love somebody, you understand them better. And if you understand, you understand that you got a gig. I'm not going to take even a $3,000 gig if it's during the week something.
If you weren't working here, can you imagine what else you'd be doing for a job?
I don't know. I was always... No matter what I did, rising to a management level and stuff I did before. So I guess, I don't know. As I said, I've been doing it for so long. I'm doing it longer than you are on this planet, so.
That is true.
You know what I mean? So it's hard. It becomes really a part of me.
One question I wanted to ask you that ties in a little bit to what we were talking about before is, I think, well, one of the interviews I read with you is with Lena Dunham in her Lenny newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked a little bit about feminism, which I get the sense is, I don't know if that's one of your favorite topics.
I changed my mind.
Oh, really?
Since the article a little bit.
Just to tell our listeners, she asked if you were a feminist and you said no.
Right.
And then you explained yourself. So how have you changed your mind?
What I saw throughout my life as being me, I guess, with purpose, with the quality of work I've ever always done. I always rose to the top. I never felt that I was held back. And so I said I'm not a feminist because of my life, the way my life went. There was no need.
Right. You seem to feel
for
like
that.
Being a woman in the comedy world hadn't made your career more complicated.
Not at all. Yeah. Not at all. I do look at it a little bit differently now. Not necessarily... I don't apply it to myself, but I definitely see it with other people.
It's interesting that you talk about how you changed your mind on calling yourself a feminist because you saw that even though you didn't feel like the sort of gendered power dynamics at work were affecting you negatively, you saw them affect other women. Was there something that made you change your mind or just thinking about it a little bit more?
Just thinking about it, because to tell you the truth, I was a little bit flippant when I said that I'm not a feminist.
Right, right, right.
Maybe I am. It just, I never gave the title to myself. So when the whole brouhaha right now that's going on about it, I said, wait a minute. I was promoted in the army. I was the boss in the army. I was what? I was 20 years old, for God's sakes. I was the head secretary of the headquarters,
wow,
which was a big, big deal. And I got it married. Nobody stood in my way. So that's why I felt, here, I do this. Nobody stood in my way. I don't know that I have as much drive as some people would think, but maybe that's what it is. And frankly, I'm happy with what's going on in my life, so I don't dissect it.
Right.
I don't give it names or labels.
Do you guys sit up? I always want to call it backstage, but do you guys sit in the Olive Tree Cafe talking about these issues, about the Me Too stuff?
I tell you the truth. I try not to. Sometimes we do. It depends who is at the table. If there are people that I know that are going to take it as I say it and not as they choose to hear it. Because I don't want to get in conflict with anybody. I have my opinions, and with some people, I'll sound off. And with some people, I just don't bother because I know that they are going, you know, like the horse with the blinkers, they are looking at it only one way. And everything is black and white, and everything is no shades of anything else. So with some people, I discuss it. Some people, I don't.
Can you ever see yourself booking for another club? Or what do you love about working here specifically?
No, I don't see myself booking another club. It would be ridiculous. After 37 years, what am I going to... I mean, never say never, you know, but no. I first of all, this is home. It's been home for so long. You know, you are expecting a child. I was told when I was expecting my son that the first 3 years are critical of you being with that child. And I worked all my life. So when I got pregnant with my son, had my son, the first 3 years I decided to be at home with him. I was climbing the walls, but that's what I did because I thought it's the best thing for him.
So you weren't working during that time?
The 3 years, right. I didn't. And then 3 years and a day, I went to work. And that's why I know exactly how long I'm here because my son last Sunday just turned 40.
Oh.
So I'm here 37 years.
What were those 3 years like for you?
Well, I was busy with him. 8 o'clock, I was pushing already the carriage to the park. I was just like doing all the things that I thought you're supposed to do. I don't know if that's right or not. Things have changed. 37.
It's almost like it's a
different generation, you know? It's hard for me because I'm in the modern days working with mostly young people. Majority of them are way younger than me. Younger than my son, I would say, or my son's age. That keeps me young and current and active. I just can't see myself doing anything else at this point. I probably would have to, because I am not good at sitting doing nothing.
When do you think you would retire? What would make you retire? Never?
Why? Well, listen, unless you have a plan to travel the world and stuff like that, I can still book while I travel, you know. I do. But, you know, we have a club in Vegas. I go to LA to audition or look at new people. You know, I have enough movement in my life not to feel stale. But why? I would get up in the morning and do what?
That's great. Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure to have you and to meet you.
It was fun. It was more fun than I thought it would be.
Wasn't
it
as you thought?
Yes.
I'm so glad to hear that.
Yes. Very easy to talk to. Very nice.
You are so easy to talk to.
That's it for this episode of Working. Thanks for listening. Again, I'm your host, Laura Bennett. If you liked the show, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. If you have any questions or comments, you can write to us at working@slate.com. Working is produced by Jessamine Molly. Special thanks to Justin D. Wright for the ad music. Come back next week for another episode on New York's Comedy Cellar.